From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. The apparent failure of school bond issues at East Valley and other Washington schools has rekindled the debate over Washington's supermajority requirement for bond issues. A new group has formed to pressure the legislature to lower that threshold to a simple majority. We'll look back at recent failed efforts to do the same, and we'll talk with the founder of that group. Are people inherently altruistic or greedy? Maybe a little of both, according to a WSU researcher who did a study exploring that using an African tribe as his subjects. And we'll talk with the Idaho Humanities Council about marking America's 250th birthday and look at how last year's plans to eliminate federal funding for humanities affected the timing of the celebration. That's this week's Inland Journal. This month's election in Spokane County brought good news to a lot of school districts. Voters approved most operations and capital levies. But a $220 million bond issue proposed by the East Valley School District went down to defeat despite receiving nearly 55% support. That's not an unusual occurrence in Washington. For years, districts all over the state have seen their bond issues fail because even though they received majority support, they didn't reach the 60% supermajority threshold. That threshold was approved by the legislature during World War II. More than 80 years later, a majority of school bond issues in Washington fail. Taxpayer advocates say that's a good thing. They believe bond issues that incur debt should be hard to pass. School administrators and elected officials, including Vancouver Democratic Senator Adrian Cortez, argue the result is a growing number of Washington schools that are unsafe, uncomfortable, and inadequate.
The school district that is in my district, or one of them, Battleground School District, has faced decades of bond failures, but decades of bond failures in which they got in excess of 50% or 55%. And they just couldn't quite hit that 60% supermajority. And it's time to turn the page on this outdated law and create a path for schools to fund basic improvements so we can better support our students.
Last year, Cortez introduced a resolution that sought to change the state constitution and allow bond issues to pass with 55% approval. That's a compromise. For many school officials, including Martin Turney from the Issaquah School District, prefer a simple majority. In February 2025, he testified at a hearing on Cortez's resolution.
A 50% approval threshold, a simple majority, would align with the standard used for levies and match the threshold used by 37 other states in the country. Our community consistently demonstrates strong support for our schools. Despite this, our recent November 2024 bond measure, which received over 50% voter approval, failed under the current 60% requirement, but the bond would have passed under a simple majority requirement. It is frustrating and disheartening to see the majority's will obstructed by an outdated threshold. As a result, it has delayed critical improvements to our schools and limited our ability to provide high-quality learning environments for all students.
That argument hasn't been persuasive to enough legislators. Cortez bid for a constitutional amendment and a companion bill didn't get far in the process last year, and neither have been given a hearing this year. A group called Washington Investing in Schools and Education, or WISE, has been created to give the legislature a nudge. Its co-president is Jared Kink.
Clearly, communities are supporting school districts with operation levies passing. If we look at this last round of elections, nearly every levy is passing in the state. Communities, really, local communities, really support their schools. But one area that makes it really difficult to support students and communities is building new schools. And the state legislature does very little to support building of schools and maintaining of schools. The districts have to rely on local dollars to do so. Unfortunately, the bar is very, very high for them to do so. It's not a simple majority, it's a supermajority. And as a result, there's a lot of school districts that pass bonds at a simple majority, but don't meet the threshold of 60%.
Kink doesn't agree with the argument that bond issues should come with a higher voter threshold because it means borrowing money and putting districts in debt.
The rules should be the same for everything. Everything should be a simple majority in America. That's a democratic principle of the majority of people say this should happen. That's what should happen. It shouldn't be held to a minority of voters hindering what a community wants to do. And I think you can get into the math of it. A lot of school districts are moving away from bonds and going to capital levies, which only need 50%. And if you do a capital levy, in the long run, those actually cost more than the bond, and it actually takes longer to accumulate the money to build. So when funding schools, bonds are the cheaper and more efficient way to build in a school district than a capital levy.
Are your views on this influenced by something in your own life?
Yeah, we had a couple rounds in the Everett School District where we were not able to pass a bond. We'd be in the high 50s, but just couldn't get that 60%. With our school district move to the capital levy approach, we didn't have a choice, really, because we had schools that were very old and needed replacing, or we had a lot of growth in one area of our district, just a mass amount of building, and we couldn't keep up with how fast houses are built. And so we have a tremendous number of portables, and that's not the best learning environment. So in order to keep up pace with our community and to be stewards of taxpayer dollars, bonds are a much faster approach than capital levies. So yes, it very much came out of kind of in many ways a dire need in our school district.
Similar proposals have stalled over the last few years in the legislature. Do you think you're close to changing their minds?
We think so. We think so. And I think a lot of legislators that in local school districts that are in the 50%, they're the ones that need to make the change. I think we have a lot of legislators going, yes, why can't I get new schools in my district? And they're passing at 50%. They're like, we need to make a change. We need to go down to simple majority, just like we did with levies. It's amazing to see some of the bonds that are passing now across the, it's across the state. Whether you're a blue district or a red district, at the end of the day, this impacts kids, this impacts communities. And we're seeing a swing towards, we got to make this change. We were only a handful of votes short last session.
It's unlikely that either of the bills in Olympia now are going to be moved this year. So Wise is looking toward next year and envisioning a change in the state constitution. That means getting the legislature's approval and then going to the ballot.
At some point, this is going to have to go to a vote of the people, which is interesting. We only need 50% of the vote of the people to change it. So we need a long runway. So we are really looking at, we want to get this issue out there. We don't want it off the radar. The next legislative session, we want to get this passed and then take it to the people. We want just looking for that long runway, because it's going to take considerable resources to do a statewide campaign to get this passed.
King says he and his group anticipate a 2 or 3 year campaign to convince voters and legislators that simple majority bond issues are the way to go.
What we can't lose sight of with this change in the law is that every student in the state deserves a safe learning environment that's going to help them be successful for the future. And when students are going to schools that are cold, they're got poor HVAC systems, and we put so much pressure on the system for results, those kids have to be in a place where they can learn to the best of their abilities, and we can see greater success when they leave. So I don't ever want to lose sight of that.
Jared Kink is the co-president of WISE, Washington Investing in Schools and Education. Human beings are complicated. Sometimes they're generous, sometimes they're selfish, sometimes they're both. Washington State University evolutionary anthropologist Christopher Smith is interested in how communities work together, especially when they're faced with change. How well do they cooperate? He's just published a study based on his work with a tribe of hunters in Tanzania.
Oftentimes, people look to hunter-gatherers to get a view of human nature. And we know that hunter-gatherers today share broadly any food they bring back to camp. They're often described as egalitarian. But what we really wanted to know is, what is the process that produces that egalitarianism? Is it that people are willing to give to one another freely? Or are they reaching equality by actually taking from those that have more? So we designed this experiment to test that hypothesis, to test those two views of human nature. So this is out in East Africa. The Hadza have been a fascinating population for anthropologists for a century, one of the last remaining hunter-gatherer populations. So this is out in a dry woodland savanna area. So they're getting most of their calories still today from foraged goods, whether that's hunting antelope, gazelle, dik-dik, or foraging for plant goods and honey.
To find the information he was looking for, Smith had members of the tribe play a game.
An economic game. So these games are really useful for understanding people's preferences under conditions of anonymity, right? So we're always concerned, right? There's always this concern about reputation and, you know, being paid back in the future. So games try to clean this up a bit. So what we do is we take people into private and we have Polaroid photos that we've taken of everyone in the camp. So we put their photo in front of them, and then we put a photo of another campmate face down. So they know it's someone in their camp that they'll be playing with, but they don't know who. And crucially, no one will know who's their decisions. We then either put 8 tokens on their photo or 4 on their campmates or vice versa. So they either have more than the other person or less. And then we let them either give or take tokens to or from the other person. And later these tokens will be exchanged for dry banana chips, which they really enjoy. And so we let them just move the tokens around, understanding that, you know, if they are taking tokens from the other person, they're taking banana chips. And if they're giving tokens, then they're giving banana chips. And so this really allowed them, again, give the option to give and take. So where previous games that have been played with Hadza and many other hunter-gatherers across the world, they usually only give the option to give. So they're given a set of tokens or a set of money, and then they can give it to the other person. Here we set up that opportunity to take from others. So to really test that idea about, are people reaching equality because they're giving, or is it because they're taking from others when they have less?
So you played the game with these hunters. What did you find?
One, we found a lot of variation. So there are some people who, even when they already have less than the other person, were willing to give more. But on the other hand, we also found people who were much selfish. In fact, most people ended up taking all of what was on the other person's photo. So a lot of people were willing to take from others. And indeed, we found that equality was much more likely to be reached when the other person started out with more because they were willing to take tokens from them. So really, we did find evidence for this idea that people are reaching equality by taking from those that have more. Though again, I do want to emphasize, we do find variation where we do find very generous folks.
So what meaning do you derive from what you observed?
That's a great question. You know, this is always a concern for anthropologists, and how do we make sure that we're generalizing in a you know, scientifically appropriate way. I think here, you know, what has always struck folks who have been doing these games with hunter-gatherer societies is that when you first, you know, reach the societies, they're well known for being generous and egalitarian. They share food. But what has repeatedly been found is that, in fact, in these games, they're often much more selfish than, say, U.S. undergrads, where they're only willing to give about 10% of what they have, whereas undergrads will give like 40 to 50%. Of course, they're all humans, right? We're looking for these universal general processes. But I think what this shows is sort of the importance of the different kinds of institutions that we find ourselves in, right? So they have more tolerance for demanding sort of that equality from one another. And indeed, one thing we find that sort of points to some universal processes is that those people who had more experience with markets and other people living outside of Hadza land were actually less willing to take, suggesting that maybe they're respecting property rights as they become more involved in markets. And ironically, is leading to more inequality because they're not willing to take when they have less. This was in collaboration with one of my co-authors, Duncan Stabert-Hawks, and who was really interested in quality. So he's been working with other folks who work in Amazonia, looking at some of these processes of inequality and egalitarianism. How are they able to reach equality and how are they not? So he has some exciting things I know in the pipeline that he's looking forward to getting out. I've unfortunately haven't had an opportunity to get back out to work with Hadza since pre-COVID, but it's definitely something I hope to follow up on, thinking how exposure to other cultures might be changing their other social behaviors and social psychology.
Christopher Smith is an assistant professor of anthropology at WSU. His paper was published this month in the journal PNAS Nexus. The United States is preparing to celebrate the 250th anniversary of its founding, the Declaration of Independence. Some will celebrate exclusively on the 4th of July. Others will be scattered throughout the year. Joanna Bringhurst, the Associate Director of the Idaho Humanities Council, says her organization has two events planned for North Idaho.
One, we have our North Idaho Distinguished Humanities Lecture in October. We're bringing astronaut Captain Scott Kelly to the Coeur d'Alene Resort. We thought that an astronaut, an author who's looked at humanity from that incredible view might have some thoughts on the human experience and what he learned and what he took away from his year living on the International Space Station and being a part of that international effort for many years. And then we are also hosting this summer in Moscow, Idaho, just across the border from Pullman, a film and folklife festival. It's called Roots of a Nation. And we're going to do a film festival, you know, have some fun looking at films that show how we remember our history through film. And we'll have humanities experts discussing and thinking about how do we remember history and how did we remember it in the past and how do we want to remember it in the future through art? And then the Folklife Festival portion will be a bunch of hands-on engagement stations. And we're hoping intergenerational families will come out and have an opportunity to do hands-on activities and learn more about life in early Idaho and our cultural heritage as Americans. And that means learning from the Idaho's tribes who were indigenous to that area, the Nimiipuu, the Coeur d'Alene, and also settlers coming from different areas. So a lot of like fun for kids to dig in the dirt and do some beading and hear storytelling and music. That's just a part of our Idaho heritage.
So tell me about when planning began for the 250th birthday celebrations with your organization?
Oh, probably 2 years ago. The reason being that because a lot of our funding comes through the National Endowment for the Humanities, we plan budgets and programs well in advance. Sometimes our funding is delayed, and working with partners all over the state of Idaho, it just requires advanced planning. One program specifically, for about 40 years, we've held a summer teacher institute every summer where we train K through 12 humanities teachers. And we had to do our America 250th summer teacher institute last summer to help teachers be prepared for this school year to commemorate the 250th with their students. And so we planned that year in advance, so 2 years.
So what sorts of things were you looking for in terms of maybe people saying, here's what we want to do for the 250th anniversary? What are some of the things that excited you when you heard ideas?
We are really interested in the humanities being a place that brings people together across divides. Everyone is welcome in the humanities, and we've been concerned about political divisiveness in our country and in our state, probably like everyone for a long time, but in recent years in particular. So the 250th is this incredible opportunity to bring people together across those political divides. And I think that was central to what was exciting and what we hoped we could accomplish during this commemoration period.
So I assume the Humanities Council put out some sort of call for ideas and programs that you would fund. What were the things that you were looking for?
So the way that we do that is through our grant program, right? We meet our mission by doing some of our own programs that we produce, like the Teacher Institute, and then doing grants. And so we had planned for a major grant round last fall, and right now, this early spring period. Unfortunately, last year, the Department of Government Efficiency illegally terminated funding to state humanities councils and to the National Endowment for the Humanities. And so our funding was cut by over 50% last year. And so we were not able to offer a major grant round either last fall or this spring. Our funding was just signed by President Trump the week before last, where the NEH is funded through the Department of Interior. And so we are expecting funding for this year to be restored to what it was at the FY 2025 levels. We hope that that will be the case and that that funding will be released as mandated by Congress. If that is the case, then we will have a major grant round this summer, and we hope that we will still be able to support meaningful programming that will happen later in the summer and in the early fall.
Yeah, that's 4.5 months away. It doesn't give your organizations a lot of time to figure it out, assuming with going with the idea that we're going to have some money to actually plan something to do.
Yeah, it's been pretty wild. I mean, I will say it's been, I think the 250th has been the most disappointing part of those cuts, not just for us, for every state humanities council and for many people who had NEH grants that were terminated. The 250th was, you know, central to a lot of that. We have been able to do some small grants. We have two grant lines that are $1,000 and less. One is an action grant and one is a K-12 grant for teachers. So we have been able to fund field trips and book purchases for K-12 teachers that are connected to the 250th. We have also been able to do action grants that are connected to the 250th. Those usually go to smaller museums, historical societies, organizations like that in rural parts of our state. We also had already, when our funding was terminated, we had already funded a program called Let's Talk About It, which is in partnership with the Idaho Commission for Libraries. And we've done this program together for many years. It is about adult book discussion groups. And for this year, we created a new theme, America's 250th, and a committee of humanities experts selected book titles connected to the 250th. And starting this spring and going into the fall, but mostly the spring and summer, there are 6 libraries in rural parts of Idaho that are hosting these discussion groups about America's 250th, the Humanities Council funding purchases the books, and we pay a stipend to humanities scholars to lead the book discussions. Each library does a discussion every month for 6 months. So they choose 6 of the titles to read.
Would in a normal year, a 250th anniversary stop on July the 4th at the 250th anniversary, or would it in a normal year, would it continue going on throughout the year, saying that 2026 is the important year, not necessarily just the date of the 4th of July?
Yeah, what we were thinking was July 4th, 2025 to July 4th, 2026 would be this buildup to the commemoration and a lot of scholarship, a lot of thinking, a lot of programs to get people thinking about, you know, what is the legacy of the Declaration of Independence? What are the principles laid out in the Declaration? And how have they shaped American history? American culture, American civil life. There's a lot of controversy around how to commemorate the 250th. Here in Idaho, we have 5 federally recognized tribes, and July 4th, 1776 is maybe not a day that they want to celebrate, but it is an opportunity for us in Idaho to consider Idaho's history and how have we as a people implemented the values of the Declaration of Independence, or how haven't we? You know, Idaho is a part of the country, and we hear part of the legacy of our founding fathers and mothers, as well as this meeting place of Indigenous people who were here for thousands and thousands of years before European settlers came. And we're also the home to so many different groups of immigrants and refugees across time who have made their home here. People seeking religious liberty, people seeking economic opportunity. And we've all come together, and we all love this land. And so this is such a great opportunity to think about what being an American means and who do we want to be.
Given the hoo-ha about immigration in the United States and who's truly an American and who's not, have you had to sort of tap dance around some of those discussion areas that might be considered, I hate to say it like this, taboo?
I don't know if tap dance is the right word, but we do believe that the humanities is like the perfect place for discussion about these controversial issues, and that we should be able to disagree with each other. We should be able to have different points, different perspectives, bring our different stories together, and still be a united people. And that's maybe something that we've forgotten how to do, or we've decided we don't like to be uncomfortable, and so we don't come together to disagree anymore. And so we more see the work of the Humanities Council as this like forum for getting comfortable being uncomfortable.
Do we anticipate we're going to have then things as far into the fall and maybe later on in this year that may have been earlier because of the your funding interruptions?
Yes. So I think the idea of beyond the 250th is something that resonates with a lot of people. And so I expect maybe that like July 4th, 2026 for the next year to July 4th, 2027 will be a time of thinking and doing programming and providing funding about now what? What are the next 50 years, the next 250 years going to be like? What do we want? What do we expect?
Joanna Bringhurst is the Associate Director of the Idaho Humanities Council. The North Idaho events she mentioned earlier will be this summer and fall. The Moscow Film and Folklife Festival will run August 28th and 29th. Former astronaut Scott Kelly's event will be October 29th at the Coeur d'Alene Resort. You can find out more at the Idaho Humanities Council website. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced by SPR News. You can hear it on the radio every Thursday at 12:30 and Saturday at 2:30, online 24/7 at SpokanePublicRadio.org. There you can also find our daily podcast, SPR News Today, hosted by Owen Henderson. Thank you for listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.